The North Carolina Reading Service presents this program for our blind and print-impaired listening audience. And it is The Independent, the Indie Week, presented weekly and read by John Fetterson today. And the issue is dated August the 21st of 2025. And a reasonably sized issue this week. I shouldn't have any problem getting through most of the articles, and I'd better do it. And here we go over to Wake County and the Wake Housing Authority. It says here they have paid down $1.3 million in debt, but it's still running out of money. That's the WCHA, the Wake County Housing Authority, the federally funded agency that administers Section 8 housing vouchers and maintains hundreds of public housing units, has managed to mostly dig itself out of a $1.9 million hole. But it is still designated as troubled by the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, and it's running out of money fast. At the WCHA's board meeting last week, Interim Director Michael Best said the agency has managed to pay down about $1.3 million in past due rental payments to local landlords this summer. That is a sizable chunk of the original $1.9 million the WCHA owed when Best arrived in April. Board member Thomas Gulisano told Best during the meeting, "You steered the ship away from the iceberg. We've gone around it, not into it, so thank you." That agency came under fire earlier this summer from landlords and tenants alike for its failure to pay its share of rent for its Section 8 voucher holders. Best told the Indy at the time that prior to his tenure, the agency failed to submit updated HUD paperwork for 260 voucher households who moved to Wake County from 114 other jurisdictions. Without that paperwork, the initial housing authorities didn't know whether to send money or how much to WCHA. Best initiated a laborious process of contacting each of the 114 public housing authorities individually to settle their accounts, and it's paying off. That progress notwithstanding, the WCHA is still in trouble. Best informed the board that its public housing units are at 82% capacity, well below HUD's optimal occupancy rate of 95.5%. He added that the WCHA has been locked out of HUD's grant disbursement system, which is known as the Line of Credit Control System, or ELOCS, since May, blocking its access to federal funding. It was unclear during the board meeting whether HUD had purposefully locked WCHA out of ELOCS or if there was a technical issue. Best did not respond to Indy's request for clarification. Regarding access to federal funds is the WCHA's top priority, said Finance Director Courtney Ozaki, because the agency currently has only $200,000 in its business bank account. Staff payroll and other outstanding expenses for the month of August total about $126,000, she said, meaning the housing authority will be left with about $86,000 at the end of the month if it cannot obtain new funding. And she said, as soon as we have access to ELOCS, we can draw over $800,000. WCHA is still designated as a troubled housing authority based on its score of 34 out of 90. That's a failing score on its most recent public housing assessment, which was conducted by HUD in 2022. The failing score triggered the prescription of a recovery plan for WZHA to increase occupancy, improve its financial performance, and improve the physical condition of its units. On its website, WZHA says it maintains 345 public units. When Indy requested more information about where these units are located and their occupancy rates, Best said a list of 264 units. Confusingly, a note attached to the list says WZHA has 337 units, 289 of them occupied. Best did not respond to Indy's question about which of these numbers is correct. We'll update this story if we hear back. Section 8 voucher recipients and public housing occupants are feeling the effects of the disarray at WZHA. 2 months ago, Indy spoke to Nancy Powell, who had to leave her house in Wendell because WZHA stopped paying its share of rent to her landlord. Earlier this month, she said the housing authority still owes money to that landlord and has already missed payments to her new landlord. She wrote in an email to Indy, "I've had issues with the housing authority not paying my prorated rent at my new location. This new property management company is what I would call no nonsense, and I fear yet another negative outcome. I'm beyond in debt, as I was forced to move and didn't have the money to do so," Powell wrote, adding that the legal aid attorneys she's working with suggested she consider a class action lawsuit against the housing authority. "That's not something Powell is pursuing right now," she wrote. Instead, she's trying to get a meeting with the governor's office to bring attention to her situation and others like it. WZHA is not the only public housing authority experiencing difficulties right now, although some of its problems are unique and self-inflicted. WRAL reported in June that Durham Housing Authority owes more than $2 million. Meanwhile, President Trump's fiscal year 26 budget request would slash HUD's rental assistance budget by $26.7 billion, or almost 43%, from the current year, according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition, which will cause new problems for the already embattled WZHA. All right, next, also from Wake County, the Wake Democrats endorse municipal candidates from Apex to Zebulon. On Tuesday evening, the Wake County Democratic Party announced its endorsements for most of the 34 municipal elections coming up this November. County Party Chair Wesley Knott tells Indy that he and his team intend to canvass 50,000 homes, win every race, and flip the Holly Springs Town Council and Fuquay-Varina Town Commission from Republican to Democrat majorities this year. And Knott says, "We are investing in these races more than we've ever invested in any municipal races in the organization's history. We will knock more doors this year than we've knocked in any municipal election. We will make more phone calls than we made in any municipal election, and we will have 100% poll greeting coverage. We're going to show this year that the Wake Dems endorsement is the determining factor in helping elect Democrats who share our values." Although Wake's municipal elections are nonpartisan, both major parties regularly endorse to avoid confusing their voters or diluting votes across multiple candidates. You can see which candidates the Wake County Republican Party endorsed here, and that there's a link that's not given to me on this article. Wake County Republican Party has made its own endorsements. Well, the WC Democratic got involved in local nonpartisan elections in 2011 after Republicans swept the Wake County School Board elections in 2009. To gain the Democrats' endorsement, candidates have to complete a questionnaire and interview with the county party's 13 top officers, who then vote on whether to endorse them or not. Approved candidates must sign the WCDP's Candidate Expectation Agreement in order to be endorsed. Knott says, We are looking for folks with leadership potential who are engaged in their community, who share our values, and who are electable and running good campaigns. We want to coalesce behind those Democratic candidates to ensure we're electing as many of those folks to office as possible. In Apex, Morrisville, and Zebulon, more Democrats are running for office than there are seats up for election. Knott says in those instances, the party chose to back the strongest, most electable people. He declined to explain specific endorsement decisions. WCDP did not endorse in the Morrisville Town Council District 4 race or in Rollsville, where three town council seats are on the ballot this fall. Three total candidates are running in that race, so they will all win regardless. The party only endorsed one candidate in Knightdale, although there are three Democrats running for three town council seats. Knott says that when the party does not endorse a Democrat running for office, it could be because they didn't seek the party's endorsement, or the party did not extend an endorsement offer, or the candidate did not sign the expectation agreement. Knott says WCDP is growing its presence in southern Wake County in hopes of flipping Holly Springs and Fuquay Varina town governments. Holly Springs Town Council is majority Republican, while in Fuquay Varina, the town commission has two Democrats, two Republicans, and one unaffiliated. Both towns have Republican mayors. Knott says, I feel like that's an area where we've lagged behind in our organizing capacity in the past, but we turned a sharp corner in 2024, and our volunteers are excited to get out there and help make some progress in some municipalities that, from our view, have not been representing our values or serving their communities well. The WCDP knocked on 45,000 doors in the run-up to the 2024 election, Knott had told Indy earlier this year. That was a big jump from 2022, when the party canvassed fewer than 2,000 households. In 25, Knott wants to do even more door knocking, which he says is achievable, since the county party has, quote, grown a ton. Turnout for Wake's odd-year municipal elections is usually very low, creating an opportunity for this kind of organizing to make a real difference. And Knott says we've raised more money so far in 25 than we did in 24, which was a presidential election year, and it's not from large dollar donors or special interest groups. It's from grassroots, everyday folks. Next, this article says here who the Wake County Democratic Party endorsed. And this alphabetical by area. Apex Town Council, Ed Gray, Sue Mue, M-U-E, and Shane Reese. Cary Town Council at Large, Carissa Johnson. Cary Town Council District A, Brittany Richards. Cary Town Council District C, Bella Huang. H-U-A-N-G. Fuquay Varina Mayor, Bill Harris. Fuquay Varina Town Board of Commissioners, Brian Haynes and Christopher Voren. In the Garner Town Council, endorsed Gra Singleton and Kevin Stallings. For Holly Springs Mayor, Mike Kondratik. And for the Holly Springs Town Council, Annie Dries, Kara Foster, and Sarah Larson. For Knightdale Town Council, Grady Bussey, or Busey, B-U-S-S-E-Y. Mayor of Morrisville endorsed T.J. Cawley. And for the Morrisville Town Council at Large, Harrison Kesling. And for Council District 2, Jashi Abhirajan. And for Morrisville Council District 4, no endorsement. There were no endorsements also for the Rollsville Town Board of Commissioners. The mayor of Wake Forest, Ben Clapsaddle. And for the Wake Forest Town Board of Commissioners, Hasib Fatmi and Keith Shackelford. Wendell Town Board of Commissioners, B.J. Barham, Deans Eatman, and Dustin Ingalls. For Mayor of Zebulon, Jessica Daniels Harrison. And for the Zebulon Town Board of Commissioners, Davaris Gardner and Quentin Miles. Now, the Indie Week online, indieweek.com, will show a complete list of all candidates running for local office in Wake County. And also, of course, the Board of Elections will show those as well. And we'll stay in Raleigh specifically for another story about St. Augustine's University. The article says they have stalled their accreditation loss with a court injunction. St. Augustine's University will be allowed to operate this fall, thanks to a preliminary court injunction that has paused its accreditor's decision to revoke its status. After years of financial struggles, the private HBCU, that's Historically Black College and University in Raleigh, lost accreditation this past July following two failed appeal attempts. Accreditation is necessary for schools to receive federal financial aid. As a final resort, schools can sue their accreditor in court to pause the decision. SAU filed a preliminary injunction in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Georgia, which was granted this week, according to a press release from the school. And it will remain accredited as long as these legal proceedings continue. Interim President Marcus Burgess said in a press release, "This is a tremendous win for St. Augustine's University and, most importantly, for our students. We've said all along we will stop at nothing to maintain our accreditation and continue serving our scholars, and we meant it." While the university said a $100,000 donation from their National Alumni Association and several individual alumni made this legal maneuver possible, it's unclear whether the institution has the funds to sustain that fight. Shortly after it lost accreditation, SAU told alumni in a virtual town hall meeting it would need $1 million to fund the lawsuit against their former accreditor, which is called the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges, SACSCOC. I'll call them SACS. While accreditation legal battles can drag on for years, it potentially buys the university time to find a new accreditor. Burgess had said previously the school is working to obtain accreditation from the Transnational Association of Christian Colleges and Schools, or TRACS. Although TRACS has fewer requirements to join than SACS, it still requires schools to demonstrate financial stability. As of mid-July, university officials estimated that SAU's current debts exceed $47 million. The school is also fighting a $20 million default judgment to pay back a vendor. While Burgess said 127 students were admitted this fall, it was unclear how many students will attend. Enrollment at the end of spring hovered around 50 students. On September 2nd, the school will begin classes, which were moved entirely online in February due to concerns with the facilities after years of deferred maintenance. The announcement also came with a significant leadership change. Brian Boulware, the university's board chair, will step down from the leadership position. He will stay on the board as a trustee, and trustee Sophie Gibson has taken over as board chair. As Indy and the Assembly previously reported, Boulware has been at the center of alumni's criticism in recent years. When one alumni group sued the school in hopes of replacing the board, it accused Boulware and the immediate past board chair of bringing the school, quote, to its knees. He also remains locked in a legal dispute with a former university trustee who sued him in 2022 for defaulting on a $600,000 loan for his cigar bar business. The former trustee is now pursuing Boulware's personal and business assets in bankruptcy court. Boulware, who has said SAU's administration mismanaged the school's finances for more than a decade, unbeknownst to the Board of Trustees, told the Assembly and Indy in spring he would consider stepping down once the university was on solid ground. The school's press release implies Boulware feels St. Aug's has reached that point. The press release said, after years of committed leadership and in light of increasing professional engagements, Mr. Boulware has chosen to step down from the chair role, confident in the strong foundation now in place for SAU's future. Well, our columnist Lena Geller takes us to Chapel Hill. The title of this article, They Can't Sell, They Can't Stay. From a Chapel Hill floodway, the future looks grim. In the middle of the night on July 6th, as Tropical Storm Chantal unleashed on Chapel Hill, Lou Horton and her husband Paul Grigante huddled in their attic with their three cats. The couple's one-story house is not positioned well for such an event. It sits in a hollow where the land drops sharply away from Fordham Boulevard, accessible only by driving down what is essentially a steep driveway off that road. You can barely see their rooftop from the street. And their house also sits on the banks of Booker Creek, a half-mile downstream from the East Gate Shopping Center. The night of Chantal, the creek became a conveyor belt for debris from Aldi, Dollar Tree, and other Eastgate businesses. From their attic, Horton and Grigante could hear but not see what was rushing past in the darkness. Horton says that was the scariest part. We heard things flowing by and smashing against the house. Anything that flowed by could have been a dumpster, a tree, or a telephone pole crashing into our house and killing us. For Horton and Grigante, the flood was both a singular catastrophe and the culmination of years spent watching their situation become more precarious. Trapped in a house no one else will buy, watching new apartment complexes spread upstream while their own land erodes into the creek, they are part of a growing class of people stuck in homes increasingly threatened by natural disasters. Climate refugees who haven't left yet. Earlier that day, around 4 p.m., Horton had moved her car to higher ground behind Squid's restaurant and pressed Grigante to do the same with his truck. Flash flood warnings had been pinging her phone all day. Grigante declined, saying his truck was out of gas. The house, built entirely of cinder blocks in 1952, had never flooded in the 22 years since he bought it. He'd been watching the radar all day and was convinced they'd be fine. Horton offered him $40 for gas to move his truck. He said no. She gave up and fell asleep, weary from working her jewelry booth at the festival for the Eno all weekend. Grigante woke her up a few hours later at 8:10 p.m. "It's flooding," he said. He'd already moved his truck and hoisted the lawnmower onto the porch. Horton watched out the window as water crept up the side of the house. When it rose to less than a foot from the sill, she rolled down the shades. "I was starting to get seasick," Horton says. She called her brother. "I was like, yeah, so I'm going to die. I'm probably going to die," Horton recalls telling him. He urged her to call 911. She tried. No one answered. The emergency system was overwhelmed with nearly 8,000 calls that night, according to Alex Carrasquillo, communications manager for the town of Chapel Hill. Horton and Grigante moved to the attic soon after. The smell of gasoline from their lawnmower that had washed off the porch filled the air as the hours passed. Around midnight, Grigante's phone rang. Horton answered. It was a first responder. Are you in your house? The responder asked. We're coming to rescue you. You'll have to rescue our neighbors first, Horton responded. They share bypass land with just one other household, an elderly couple who lives with three adult children, according to Horton. The responder assured Horton they were talking to the neighbor's son. That's how they'd known to call Grigante. We're coming to get you. We just have to get a boat here. But the rescue never materialized. No one came to get them, and they didn't receive another call. The water receded around 1:30 in the morning. At its height, it had reached 2 feet inside their house. Horton and Grigante climbed down from the attic and met their neighbors in the middle of what remained of their shared driveway, comparing notes. The neighbors hadn't even realized Horton and Grigante were home. The adult children had gone to move their cars soon after Grigante did, and by the time they returned to the intersection of Bypass and Fordham, they couldn't make it back through the floodwaters. After hours waiting by the side of the road, they'd been spotted by Chapel Hill police, who called for a water rescue upon learning their parents were trapped inside. But the boat the first responders brought had no motor, and they determined the water was moving too quickly to use it. Carrasquillo confirmed the attempted rescue to Indy, writing that firefighters had tried to perform a rescue but could not safely do so in the fast-moving water. In the immediate aftermath of the flood, Horton and Grigante have been displaced and nearly all their belongings destroyed. Grigante has FEMA flood insurance, but it currently only covers the structure, not personal property. Horton's livelihood is also on indefinite hiatus. She makes money selling handmade copper jewelry and renting out a kiln in her backyard. The night of the flood, her shed full of jewelry supplies floated 200 feet before crashing into a neighbor's car. Her packaging and shipping materials were swept away. Over a month later, the kiln is still airing out. Grigante is disabled and not currently working. Horton provides their only income. With scant savings to cushion the blow, they're scrambling to figure out what comes next. But the long-term reality is harder to confront. The couple knows another flood like this will come, and they have nowhere to go. Horton happens to be the great-granddaughter of the dairy farmers who once owned that swampy land where Eastgate Shopping Center was built in 1958. That has nothing to do with the fact that she lives right next to it. I did not inherit anything, she wrote in an email to Indy. I'm a millennial. I'm poor as shit. The house where she and Grigante live sits in a FEMA-designated floodway, Zone AE, the highest-risk flood zone where water naturally flows during major flood events. This designation was not in place when Grigante purchased the property for $121,000 in 2003, drawn by its affordability and natural setting on just under a half acre. At the time, it was designated generally as being in a 100-year floodplain. Horton says the meaning was unclear, but not something that seemed threatening or devastating. Over the years, they'd experienced some flooding in the crawl space, but nothing that threatened the living space of the house. In October of 2018, FEMA updated its maps, officially designating their property as part of that floodway. Unrelated to the new FEMA designation, Horton and Grigante put their house on the market that year. Major changes were coming to the area surrounding Bypass Lane after a 100-acre site known as the Blue Hill District had been rezoned in 2014 to encourage dense, mixed-use development, and Horton was growing worried the development would increase the risk of flooding. They left the house on the market for 2 years. There were no takers. Then came the wave of new development in 2021. Chapel Hill began construction of the Elliott Road extension, a project that would connect South Elliott Road to Ephesus Church Road, cutting through the middle of Bypass Lane. The stated goal of the extension was to improve connectivity within the Blue Hill District, envisioned to be a walkable, quote, live-work-play environment. Around the same time, new apartments began sprouting up throughout the district, straight up the hill from Horton and Grigante's backyard. The Hartley at Blue Hill, 414 luxury apartments across 12 buildings, plus a 500-space parking deck, replaced the park at Chapel Hill, a much smaller complex that had offered some of the town's last naturally affordable housing. Of course, across the street, Ram Realty began construction on Bell Chapel Hill, a 273-unit complex that would reduce an area where water naturally collected by 20%. As part of accommodating the new development, the town poured money into stormwater improvements, including a $1.1 million project to expand the floodplain between East Gate and South Elliott Road, creating more space to hold water during storms. The Blue Hill District's stormwater infrastructure is rated for 100-year storm events. That means storms that statistically have a 1% chance of occurring in a different year, in a given year, excuse me. Chantel, a 500 to 1,000-year storm, per meteorologists, overwhelmed its capacity. But these classifications, technical terms based on historic data, increasingly fail to capture the new climate reality. Danielle Spurlock, a UNC professor specializing in land use and environmental planning, says this mismatch between infrastructure design and extreme weather is becoming the norm. And she says, in this case, I would say the town did the most they could do, but because of climate change, it's not going to be enough. That thousand-year storm, it's not going to be another 1,000 years before it shows up again. Spurlock adds that municipalities typically approach stormwater management parcel by parcel, rather than thinking cumulatively about watershed impact. Even when developers follow all the rules, the collective effort of more impervious services can overwhelm downstream areas during extreme weather events, she says. When asked about the impact of the town's development decisions on flooding at Bypass Lane, Carrasquillo wrote in an email, quote, 6 and 7 bypass lanes are entirely within the floodway, which is the highest chance area for flooding, and this was a historic storm in our community. And he said the Elliott Road extension, quote, was designed and built to meet all applicable stormwater ordinances. And all projects in the Blue Hill District, quote, are required to build stormwater systems that manage some of the pre-existing impervious surface on the site. From where Horton stands, that is to say, on increasingly eroding banks, the technical compliance means little. She says, I can't live here. It's ruined. There's nothing I can personally do to make this land safe. Parsing the impacts of a historic storm from those of upstream development is not straightforward. It's clear from aerial imagery there are significantly more impervious surfaces and fewer trees in that watershed. It's harder to say how severe the flooding the night of July 6 would have been without those changes. What's certain is that storms are getting worse, and the people who can least afford to relocate are trapped in harm's way. Spurlock says, we have done so little to protect the individual homeowner within the system. We've depended on these very ecologically vulnerable areas to provide affordable housing. The system, she adds, quote, is acting according to its design. the design was going to place them at risk, and we placed them at risk. We said that's a risk we're okay with. That's on the individual homeowner, and we don't give them a pathway out. 9 days after Tropical Storm Chantal, 10 volunteers from a disaster relief group, Baptists on Mission, make an hour drive from Thomasville to Bypass Lane. Horton and Grigante aren't home. They've been staying in Raleigh with Grigante's sister. Early in the week, Horton had seen a flyer at a disaster relief center in Carrboro and registered her address. She figures this is how the Baptist on Mission knew to come. The volunteers gather in a circle and join hands to pray before getting started. Then they get to work. The crew's leader, Adrienne Cromer, has a no-nonsense attitude and a brisk benevolence about her. She does a walk-through of the house alone first and waves the others in. She says, there's going to be mold growing under those floors. I can smell it. Outside, Horton and Grigante's belongings lay scattered across the yard, waterlogged and sticky from the humidity. Lamps, wooden furniture, metalworking tools, sketchbooks, balls of yarn, an ironing board, baking pans, pants and shirts lay flat on the grass like a rapture scene. One volunteer calls out, anything that looks artsy goes right here, carefully placing a piece of Horton's copper jewelry in a plastic bin. Around the side of the house, the banks of the creek are piled high with fallen branches and garbage from Eastgate. It looks like somebody TP'd the trees with plastic shopping bags. During that flood, 6 dumpsters floated past the home, says Horton. OWASA crews came a few days later to haul them away, as well as an additional one that had lodged in a culvert under Fordham Boulevard. The Baptist on Mission work into the afternoon, hauling bigger items from the house, a piano, an organ, a furniture set Horton had recently inherited from her grandmother, and piling them into a dump trailer Horton borrowed from a friend. The next day, Horton's dad drove the trailer to a landfill and paid $56 to dispose of it. Horton cannot see any reliable way to prepare her property or herself for the next big storm. She's attempted some do-it-yourself erosion control over the past few years, but the flood tore up the dogwood tree, gardenia bush, and weeds she'd been trying to cultivate to hold that eroding bank. The larger trees that would remain present their own dilemma. Horton and Grigante fear them falling on their house, but cutting them down would accelerate the erosion further. She's looking into expanding their flood insurance to cover personal property, but that takes time and money they don't have right now, and also feels somewhat futile. Insurance won't bring them back to life if they drown in the next storm. When it comes to their physical safety, the only protection is knowing when to evacuate, but official systems offer limited help, says Horton. Flash flood warnings are sent out constantly for their area. Horton and Grigante aren't going to evacuate for all of them. And while Orange County issues evacuation orders through its OC alert system during predictable floods, flash flooding presents unique challenges. According to Will Glenn, Orange County's Community Relations Director, Glenn wrote in an email to Indy, unlike a riverine flooding scenario or a dam failure, where a river floods out of its banks in predictable fashion, flash flooding is nearly impossible to predict with the accuracy necessary to effect a coordinated evacuation. Ahead of Chantal, the county issued a voluntary evacuation note for communities within the inundation area of the Lake Michael Dam, Glenn wrote, but by the time the need for evacuation in other areas became clear, it was too late to issue a mass order. Sending a general notice to evacuate without context of the safe routes could have potentially made the situation worse by putting residents on flooded roads. with no reliable early warning system. Horton says she's found herself grasping at anything that might offer guidance. The night of the storm, she'd even half wondered if the full moon might make things worse. Something about the tides, she reasoned. And she says, we have to read the tea leaves and say, hey, do you think it's going to flood? I don't know. Should we move our cars? I don't know. This is how broken it is. It's like, why don't I just deal myself a little tarot card spread? Well, let's talk about RDU Airport. On Tuesday, the public got its first official opportunity to weigh in on the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority's plans for 136 acres of parkland along the shores of Lake Crabtree, since it announced last month it was going to create a, quote, recreation and wellness destination on the property. The consensus? As they did at the beginning of the year, members of the public seemed to want to keep the property, home to a hilly, densely wooded 9-mile network of mountain biking trails, which were closed earlier this summer, as natural as possible. At a public workshop hosted in the ballroom of Carey's Senior Center from 4 to 7 p.m., dozens of people dropped in to hear from Airport Authority staff, developers, and their attorneys about their vision for the land that Wake County has leased from the Airport Authority since the 1980s at the vastly discounted rate of $1 per year. Last month, the Airport Authority announced it was exploring options for creating a recreation and wellness destination on that land located near Aviation Parkway and I-40. In partnership with Pacific Elm Properties. That's a Dallas-based real estate investment and development firm owned by Tom Dundon, who also owns the Carolina Hurricanes and soon the NBA's Portland Trailblazers. Pacific Elm is also spearheading development in the upcoming sports and entertainment district surrounding Lenovo Center, formerly PNC Arena, the longtime home of the Hurricanes. The Airport Authority signed a 20-year lease agreement with Wake County in June to preserve 70 acres of the parkland that run directly along the banks of Lake Crabtree for a market rate of $215,000, which increases 3% each year. According to a memorandum of understanding the Airport Authority released last month, Pacific Elm has an exclusivity period till July of next year to conduct studies and engineering evaluations for any development it proposes. The Airport Authority's website states potential features of the recreation and wellness destination include water sports, land sports, family-focused activities, retail, food, beverage establishments, and lodging. And indeed, all such features were on glossy poster board display at the workshop. Staffed stations started with conceptual ideas and a rendering of what the recreation destination could ultimately look like. Destination aims to, quote, celebrate trails and natural resources and provide, quote, active recreational entertainment that complements the existing trail system next to the lake, which will remain undisturbed, according to a poster. This could include, quote, family-focused activities, outdoor festivals, gathering space, camping and lodging, educational programs, bike and kayak rentals, and mountain bike racing facilities, with emphasis on hospitality for race participants, end quote. The next station depicted images of several other representative projects that served as points of inspiration, including Sierra Nevada Brewing in Asheville, the U.S. National Whitewater Center in Charlotte, Nantahala Outdoor Center in Bryson City, Riversport OKC in Oklahoma City, and Trestle Bike Park and Cannon Gorge Park in Winter Park and Cannon City, Colorado. The staffers, airport authority employees and reps from Pacific Elm and the law firm Parker Poe stuck to talking points while interacting with visitors. The airport authority owns that property in question. It's been leasing it for far too long for way below market rate, and the Federal Aviation Authority is mandating that the airport find ways to monetize the property. The developers are still in the conceptual phase of the planning process and currently working to gather community input, they said. Community input was delivered with a series of stickers on yet more poster boards. Green stickers denoted a go, yellow were a no. Images of kayakers, hikers, climbers, and mountain bikers received the most green stickers, while images of dense buildings, offices, retail, and lodgings got the most yellow. Images of food trucks, an outdoor restaurant patio overlooking the lake, and a bike shop also got some green, while tree canopy looked to be selected as the most important development theme. At the final station, visitors were invited to write their own ideas about what they want to see on sticky notes and post them. They included dozens of earnest pleas to keep the trails and mountain biking features as they are, or as green as possible. To more niche and unique proposals, a donut shop, Turkish ice cream, a trampoline park, and a faux hot springs pool. Some advised planners to collaborate with the Wake County Park System and address pollution in the lake. No tall buildings, more than one sticky note implored. Preserve green space. Ensure some unpaid free activities. Still, some attendees seemed to support Pacific Elm's early proposals. One liked the idea of having an amphitheater or live entertainment venue. Others suggested a whitewater center or campgrounds. Now, the public has two more opportunities to submit feedback in person this fall. That will be at a public workshop at Raleigh's Laurel Hills Community Center on September 2nd, and one at Frontier RTP on October the 21st. All right, let's talk about medical careers. For undergraduate nursing students, practical experience out in the field is invaluable, but it can also be nerve-wracking. Catherine Chapman, a senior nursing student at North Carolina Central University, says, "When we're out shadowing nurses for clinicals, we have strict rules about what we're allowed to do and not allowed to do. The patient is a real person, so you have that concern of, what if I make a mistake?" Now, nursing students like Chapman can learn important skills in a low-risk, low-stress environment thanks to a new immersive interactive room at the Department of Nursing, which was unveiled last Thursday, during a ribbon-cutting ceremony and demonstration. NC Central is the first nursing program in the state to host the interactive technology. Yolanda Van Riel, Central's Department of Nursing Chair, says this immersive room represents a leap forward in how we teach, learn, and simulate real-world scenarios. With cutting-edge interactive technology, our students can experience complex situations in a safe, controlled environment, strengthening their critical thinking, their cultural humility, and readiness for practice in a diverse and evolving healthcare system. Inside, the new interactive lab projectors displayed on three adjoining walls create an immersive experience. The system comes preloaded with thousands of unique environments. Fans in the room can even pour in different smells, further enveloping participants in the experience. Tina Scott, an Experiential Learning Center director for the department, says, We can actually pipe in gas, burning rubber, or have the wind blowing. Say we're in the emergency department and we have a patient that arrives with a GI bleed, passing blood. It has a very distinct smell. We can take that scent and actually pipe it into the room. During the virtual tutorial, attendees get to ride along in an ambulance, take a trip to the emergency room, people watch under the Eiffel Tower, and decompress on a cozy beach, though there were no accompanying smells of salt water or sunscreen. The technology is a combination of 3D-enabled software and hardware that includes sounds and haptic feedback, that's touch feedback, providing students and professors with a space to create real-world scenarios in a controlled environment. Users can talk with the virtual patients and review their charts. NC Central IT technician Michael Render worked with a product vendor, Echo Healthcare, to develop custom programs specific to the nursing program's needs. The department plans to collaborate with other students and groups like the art department to build more customized assets that can be used in that immersion room. Other departments could also have the chance to leverage the technology in the future. Noah Lager, a rising senior nursing student and Render, served as tour guides during a walkthrough of the program's features. Large touchscreen icons appeared on the walls the guides used to navigate the tutorial. A disembodied voice read out a greeting as information about the nursing program's history filled the screens that stretched around the room. At the end of Thursday's demonstration, folks in the room, including Central's Chancellor Carrie Dixon, tested their scientific knowledge with the game of Who Wants to Be a Medical Millionaire? NC Central has over 100 students in the nursing program split between on-campus learning and online. Students come to the program in three ways. Traditional four-year undergrad students, accelerated second degree students who transfer to the school with an associate's degree, and online through the RN to BSN program for registered nurses learning to earn a Bachelor of Science degree in nursing. Central was the first school in the system of UNC to launch an online degree program for adult learners through the Project Kitty Hawk Online Learning Initiative. The school began operating a similar immersive program last year through a partnership with 3B Scientific, which provides the nursing program with lifelike, responsive mannequins that students use in conjunction with VR headsets to work through various training modules. The immersion room adds another layer to the training, taking it out of the theoretical. Chapman says, with this room, the VR and our mannequins, it's not a living, breathing person, so you can practice and learn correct practices and build proper habits and safe habits before you interact with a real person. Scott says the technology also saves the department money. Flexibility and customization capabilities allow the faculty to simulate thousands of scenarios without the need to build initial spaces in the physical world. If a class wants to simulate performing surgery in an emergency department or making a house call to a patient's apartment, there's an immersive environment for that. Like Leonardo DiCaprio in Inception, the boundaries are only limited by what the students can dream up. Scott says you don't have to build a whole lot of rooms when you can actually just build your scenarios. Overall student enrollment at NC Central has grown in the past few years. Online enrollment in particular is up 22% compared to 2024, and pre-nursing, both in-person and online, is one of the school's most popular programs. In a competitive higher education market, unique assets like the immersion room and the school's online degree programs are vital recruiting tools. Scott says, it will let students know they're going to a university that's not behind the eight ball. They're going to a university that has cutting-edge technology that's going to train them using that technology. So therefore, they're going to graduate already ahead of the game. And already we're coming to an end. Just a time to just outline a week's events that the Indy has selected for various reasons to put in a one-page article. A Good Boy is a play playing at UNC's Keenan Theater up until Sunday, August the 24th. A limited-run production of A Good Boy by a local theater group, Hidden Voices. UNC's Keenan Theater, that'd be where you go for info. Smash and Slam, at the Eno Arts Mill, who lost their work in the floods from Tropical Storm Chantal. You can go to Proximity Brewing Company in Durham on Sunday. And that would be slam poetry with some noted local artists there squaring off in pairs. A portion of the proceeds goes to Eno Arts Mill. That's with food and drink as well. Elizabeth Dickinson presents Claire McArdle, the designer who set women free. That's on Tuesday the 26th, Flyleaf Books, Chapel Hill. Claire McArdle, an active young girl who hated feeling restricted in the frocks of the day. And that you can go to Flyleaf Books, and that's a book release, and there will be signed copies. Also, a paperback launch of Survival is Promise, The Eternal Life of Audre Lorde. Finally, PBS North Carolina presents The Great Cover-Up. That's, I won't even tell you what that will be like. The Triangle Music Tradition. And that's Wednesday the 27th at the Rialto Theater in Raleigh. Whew. So, John Fetterson must bid farewell to you from the North Carolina Reading Service. And this edition will be a podcast and kept in our library, our vaults. And we encourage you, though, there's much more in this publication than I can read in an hour. IndyWeek.com is your online source for all these articles, including an impressive backlog or library of past articles that I have never read. And we hope that you'll come back next week for the next weekly edition of The Independent. And thank you very much to listening for the North Carolina Reading Service. From John Fetterson, we say so long for now.